Hey gang, this episode is brought to you by Means TV, the world's first anti-capitalist streaming service. Stick around after the episode to learn a bit more about Means and to snag a nice little discount as a thank you for supporting my channel. Okay, so there's a building in Tribeca that we think is an NSA base of operations. Let's see how many cameras we can get caught on the way there. Now, there are about 15,000 cameras in New York, and by best estimates, you'll pass about 100 publicly accessible ones just to get to Lower Manhattan. Here's a map. And you know what? Here's two random blocks in Bushwick. Again, 15,000 cameras. 15,000 cameras that, by some estimates, can identify you from over two blocks away. They're pretty much everywhere, and if cops have access to them, you can bet they'll be combined with automated facial recognition software. Just between 2017 and 2021, the NYPD used facial recognition tech in 22,000 cases, including to track down BLM protesters back in 2020. That's because this software, according to The Intercept, can automatically tag activities like loitering, no chance that's ever problematic, and automatically index things like people's race and gender. Nothing to worry about there either. But cameras are just one part of the arsenal of surveillance tools that cops have at their disposal. Since they've become much more common, cops have repurposed body cams for everyday surveillance, sent out drones to film protests, used special automated license plate readers all over the city, set up fake cell towers to collect phone call data, and a lot more to keep track of where people are, who they're talking to, and what they do at all times. And they're not the only ones. Regular apps on your phone have found crazy ways to track you too. A few years ago, a French app for finding hotels and restaurants was found by the Yale Privacy Lab to track its users' location. Not with the GPS on your phone, mind you, but by having speakers in public locations make a sound that humans can't hear, but our phones can pick up. And that pales in comparison with the mountains of data companies like Google, Facebook, and Amazon have on us. Google stores your search history indefinitely, even in incognito. But even when you're not using the search function, Google tracking infrastructure is on 92 of the top 100 websites and 923 of the top 1,000. With how much Google owns or can access through the websites it has a back door for, the company has data on everything from your location to your address, email, and name, all the links you click on, how long you spend on any one page, what you buy, and who you talk to. And since the Snowden leaks, we know that all that info can get fed upstream to surveillance agencies like the FBI and NSA. Through programs like Prism, Boundless Informant, and XKeyscore, the NSA taps Microsoft, Google, Facebook, and Apple servers to search through emails, online messages, and browsing history. And if that's not enough, these same programs allow the NSA to use AT&T and Verizon's records to collect the time, location, and people involved in a phone call for millions of Americans without any need for prior authorization. Just to give you an idea, according to the Brennan Center, the FBI conducted 3.4 million warrantless searches on Americans' phone calls, emails, and text messages in 2021 using a law that, on paper, can only be used to spy on foreigners overseas, which is already problematic. This is a lot, and there's way more, but we'll get to that in a minute. Because first I want to know how we got here. The amount of surveillance we can be subjected to at a moment's notice is truly dystopian. Most of us would rather not think about the public-private partnership between the police, federal agencies, and tech companies built on collecting millions of hard drives worth of personal data. How did this happen? Our story starts here in Silicon Valley. Here on Sand Hill Road is where, in 1999, the CIA backed the private nonprofit venture capital firm, InQtel. Initially, InQtel was a pretty unimportant little office meant to keep an eye on Silicon Valley, fund a few things here and there, and see if tech companies were coming up with anything useful for the intelligence community. An experiment meant to last 5 years, nothing more. Just down the road, about a 20-minute drive away and less than a year before, Google launched their own little company out of a garage, a search engine meant to compete with the likes of Yahoo and AltaVista. And for a while, neither of these companies mattered very much. Google was a fledgling company, just one search engine of many, and InQtel was proving to be somewhat of a failed CIA experiment, a 5-year project that hadn't really done much of anything. Neither was this a great time for advocates of more surveillance. The scale of the internet was steadily growing in the late 90s, and Americans started feeling that this might threaten their privacy. So, after years of letting internet companies self-regulate, in 2000, the government started moving. Robert Pitofsky, the FTC chairman, was in the New York Times boldly coming after dot-com companies and saying e-commerce threatened to intrude on people's personal lives. And legislation was drafted to protect what people did on the internet. It required companies to limit what personal details they could collect, as well as make it clear what they were collecting, how it was used, and give people the option to correct it or delete it entirely. So, basically, everything Google, Amazon, and Facebook do now would have either become illegal or subjected to a lot of public scrutiny with the law on the side of internet users. To give you an idea, in the fall of 2000, the Clinton administration wanted to raise the legal requirement before law enforcement could access emails, and was actually criticized by Republicans for not doing enough to protect privacy. And then everything changed after 9/11. Okay, let's go backwards from where we just ended. First, the legislation. 45 days after 9/11, Congress passed the Patriot Act. Pretty much overnight, all those concerns about privacy went out the window. A state of emergency was declared, and terrorism became the mainstream diet of American media consumption. This neatly paved the way for the Patriot Act and the barrage of policies that followed, which all made it much easier for the government to monitor phone calls and emails, collect banking and credit records, and keep a closer and closer eye on what Americans do online. Through what are called national security letters, for example, the FBI could obtain all sorts of personal information about Americans without the approval of a judge. They could hold on to it indefinitely and prevent those who have been tapped from even talking about it, assuming they ever found out. Second, Google. All those FTC regulations went out the window too. Internet companies had started getting reasonably worried that the World Wild West and their cattle baron status within it wasn't going to survive the anti-surveillance FTC and the American public's reasonable fear of mass invasions of privacy. After 9/11, though, every regulatory project that could have threatened them was immediately canned. Third, InQtel. After 2001, gone were the days of the temporary little CIA experiment in Silicon Valley. With 9/11, InQtel became a permanent fixture in California and suddenly got a lot of interest from Valley startups looking to trade the surveillance tech they had developed and the data, which they were suddenly completely justified in collecting, legally speaking, for government cash. And in the next decade, no one took greater advantage of that than Google. In late summer 2003, Google scored a $2 million gig to set up Google search technology at the NSA and separately customize software for the CIA. Then the next year, Google deepened the connection by acquiring another CIA/InQtel-funded venture called Keyhole, a satellite mapping company that would become Google Earth. In 2007, Google's Peter Norvig gave a presentation at the Pentagon's Highlands Forum, an incubator for SV companies that the intelligence community tapped for surveillance ideas. And in 2009, Google took things even further, joining forces with the CIA's InQtel again to fund a startup called Recorded Future that monitored, quote, every aspect of the web in real time in order to predict future events. All the while, top people are, of course, rotating back and forth between these intelligence agencies and Google. Point is, after 9/11, Google and the intelligence community kickstarted a process of codependent growth. If things looked a little dicey for them in the 90s, a combination of close personal relationships and, quote, direct sponsorship and informal networks of financial influence pushed Google further and further down the path of surveillance technology at precisely the same time as the legal infrastructure meant to protect privacy was dismantled. This was a perfect symbiotic relationship. Intelligence agencies needed surveillance capitalist companies, and they needed the intelligence community's financial and institutional support. For companies, getting cozy with intelligence agencies protects their ability to burrow ever more deeply into our private data. So long as cops can get warrantless access to Ring footage, for example, Amazon can feel pretty confident in its ability to develop what has essentially become the largest corporate aggregated network of CCTV cameras on Earth. And if this wasn't clear enough, they've even gone so far as to lay out a four-part plan specifically for police departments to follow so they can increase the number of people in a neighborhood who will get a Ring camera. Then on the other side of the relationship, intelligence agencies and police forces are deeply dependent on these companies. No intelligence agency can compete with the amount of information a private company can collect and store. The NSA can't convince anyone to willingly put a GPS tracker in their pocket at all times the way Google can. There's another benefit for intelligence agencies and police departments, though. Despite the Patriot Act and the avalanche of anti-privacy laws that sailed through Congress after 9/11, the Constitution still makes it at least a little difficult for government agencies to spy on Americans. Not impossible, but either too slow or not quite unlimited enough for the likes of the NSA. Thankfully for the intelligence community, there's a loophole. To quote legal scholar Jack Balkin, "Because the Constitution does not reach private parties, government has increasing incentives to rely on private enterprise to collect and generate information for it. In other words, by contracting out both the labor of developing surveillance technology and carrying out the actual work of data collection, then simply partnering with tech companies to parse that information, surveillance can be as comprehensive and immediate as the NSA wants without having to contend with what few legal protections limit government spying on citizens." And this all perfectly coincided with some internal developments at Google that would supercharge this data collection even further. Take a look at this patent. In 2005, Google filed a patent for what it called generating user information for use in targeted advertising. There's a lot of diagrams in there that, frankly, don't make it any easier to understand what they're actually patenting, but that's not what really matters. What you need to know is the story behind this patent. That for years and years, Google was struggling. They had raised tons of money from investors and established a pretty dominant place in the search engine market. Now they just needed to figure out how to actually generate revenue doing that. Google knew they couldn't really charge people a fee without killing the business. Nor could they start selling search results that they had aggregated for free and without prior consent from website owners. So up to that point, Google was making do running just a few ads related to what you searched and providing web services for bigger names like Yahoo. Nothing terribly lucrative. And when the dot-com crash hit in 2000, investors realized this wasn't going to make enough money to justify taking a risk on the brand new commercial internet. They needed something else. It all clicked in April of 2001, just 5 months before 9/11, Amit Patel, one of the first people to work at Google, found out that every time someone ran a search through the engine, Google happened to collect information on that search like, quote, "the number and pattern of search terms, how a query is phrased, spelling, punctuation, dwell times, click patterns, and location." Data that, up to that point, Google didn't really have any use for and was just sitting in some server somewhere. What Patel and Google's founder Larry Page realized in April, though, is that all this information could not only be used to improve Google's public-facing service, the search engine, but could be of huge interest to the much more profitable advertising backend. With all this data at their fingertips, Google realized that they could not only know a lot more about what people did on the internet, but actively predict and therefore guide their behavior too, making detailed behavioral profiles that made them incredibly attractive to a whole new class of advertisers and financial institutions desperate to understand and find new profit opportunities in people's behavior. Over the next few years, then, Google went from accidentally stumbling across this extra data to reorienting its entire project around acquiring more of it. From every possible source, not just their search engine, faster and in more granular detail than any of its competitors. And crucially, before regulation could catch up, and at the exact same time that 9/11 brought out the intelligence community's support and money for massive data mining projects. That same year, Larry Page made this new direction pretty explicit. When asked what Google was after it discovered all this behavioral data, Page didn't just say a search engine. He said, quote, "If we did have a category, it would be personal information, communications. Sensors are really cheap. Storage is cheap. Cameras are cheap. People will generate enormous amounts of data. Everything you've ever heard or seen or experienced will become searchable. Your whole life will be searchable." To 20 years ago, that probably seemed impossible. Today, that project has become a reality. Now, we all know that Google sells algorithm-generated results trained on our data to advertisers. But advertising is really just the tip of the iceberg. For example, financial institutions and their tech startups have recently started to use the wave of big data that Google unleashed to assign things like creditworthiness to people on scarily specific data. Data like how often you charge your phone, your decision to add last names to contacts or not, what time of day you make phone calls, how many miles you drive a day, and if you send more texts than you receive. Based on this information, these companies calculate with more and more certainty the risk of lending associated with individual borrowers and sell that certainty at a premium. With the cost for a loan going up for consumers the algorithm has decided can't be trusted because they saved their contacts wrong. But anyway, at this point, I probably need to address something that's been bothering some of you since the beginning of this video. Most of us already knew a lot of this stuff. It's scary, it's dystopian, and we don't often actually think about just how much companies, police forces, and intelligence agencies know about us. But we all knew it was a lot. We've seen the needle move a little bit after Snowden, but it's not like any of this has really stopped. So for years now, these tech companies have told us that this is just the way it has to be. If we want to use their products for free, we have to accept that this invasion of privacy is the trade-off. And we can trust them that it won't be used problematically. They won't be evil, after all. It's that old saying, if it's free, then you're the product. But that's just not true. It's actually worse. We're not the product for these companies, we're the raw material. They're not selling us to advertisers and credit companies, they're selling the prediction models they've built using our information as fuel. But it's not like these companies don't have a choice. When Google was coming up, other search engines like the long-gone Overture and Inktomi made money in other ways that still gave us a free product, either collecting revenues from the pages they indexed or promoting advertisers' pages in the search results. The reason Google made it big isn't because its mass collection and re-engineering of our personal data was the only way to make the service free. It's because it's the most profitable way to make money when the state is there to protect and directly finance this total disregard for privacy. If anything, Ring doorbells have made this point clearer. For $50, you add yet another CCTV to your street, and they still collect massive amounts of information that can at any point be turned over to the cops without a warrant. The product isn't free. It's not really clear how much of your privacy you're handing over or what you can do to limit it. But it's so normalized that the tired line about if it's free, you're the product doesn't even matter anymore. But okay, if it doesn't have to be this way and the whole free thing is BS, at least all this surveillance makes us safer, right? We traded in some of our privacy, sure, but at least we gained in security. Except that's not true either. We have so much data that shows how useless the global post-9/11 surveillance regime has been. A 2014 study with a sample of 225 terrorist cases found that the NSA's metadata collection, quote, had no discernible impact on preventing acts of terrorism. A 2015 RAND Corporation analysis of 176 terrorist plots found that, quote, plots are most often foiled through conventional law enforcement activities, and that intelligence efforts only intervened in a small percentage of cases. Keith Alexander, former chief of the NSA, famously claimed that his agency had foiled 54 terrorist plots thanks to the massive amount of data they collected on Americans after the Patriot Act. Then, when he was pressed about it under oath, Alexander would only admit that the NSA surveillance had played an important role in one instance, a case of a cab driver sending $8,500 to Al-Shabaab. Surveillance doesn't make us safe. It isn't a trade-off we have to accept for free products. It is one thing and one thing only, an infection. The outcome of an insatiable surveillance capitalism that took advantage of a momentary weakness in our immune system, a little gap in our collective concern for the importance of our personal privacy, to settle in and spread. And now that it's here, police forces, intelligence agencies, and private corporations all collaborate to increase its scope. No protest is safe from being tracked by Google's location services or police drones. Walmart calls the FBI at the drop of a hat when its union workers start striking. Tech companies can use the weather app on your phone to track when you attend an abortion clinic and then sell that data to the CDC or anyone with the cash to dox people getting a private medical procedure. And with all these systems in place to track all this information, The truth is that it doesn't matter if you're actually being watched or you think you have nothing to hide. The fact that the infrastructure is here, and the threat that it could be turned onto you at any moment for any reason, is horrifying enough. In this neoliberal dystopia where financial institutions are desperately looking for more certainty about the future, where companies evade more and more regulation that would protect the public, and where governments strip the budgets of every institution but the Pentagon and the police, there's absolutely no reason for anyone in power to stop this. It's already impossible to avoid this invasion of privacy. There's not going to be a market solution to shutting down this perfect coalition of interests between the institutions of the state and those of capital. But the thing is, we need privacy. We need it to feel safe and comfortable in our own homes. We need privacy to be able to organize, voice our discontent, and challenge the entrenched power of the ruling class. Without it, there's no possibility for change. When you've got tech and intelligence groups watching you shop, listening to your calls, reading your private messages, actively trying to develop a real-life future crimes division, there's no safe way to exist and engage with society. Even if right now your data is just being used to sell you a more tailored product, realize that it could be used for a lot more. Think about that the next time you do anything online, or through text, or under the watchful eye of the security cameras. As I mentioned at the beginning of the video, you can now find Second Thought on Means TV, the home for worker-owned entertainment. I've been working with the team to bring on a bunch more creators, so stay tuned for some exciting new additions to the roster. If you're not already familiar with Means, it's a worker-owned cooperative and explicitly anti-capitalist streaming service. You can find everything from my videos, to original series like Means Morning News, to feature-length documentaries like Abby Martin's Gaza Fights for Freedom, with more amazing content being added every day. As you all know, socialist creators have to walk a fine line here on YouTube. We're always having to contend with age restriction, demonetization, and outright suppression, which for some reason, right-wing outlets never have to deal with. But now with Means TV, we're able to say things the way they are. No pulling punches, no beating around the bush to trick the all-seeing eye of the algorithm. Means TV gives us the freedom to make the content we really want to make and say the things we really want to say. There's even a community forum where creators can engage with each other and their fans right on the platform. And the best part is, Means TV is ideologically dedicated to supporting principled socialist content. As a little thank you for watching my channel, if you sign up with my link, you can get your first month 20% off. Or for an even better deal, you can opt for the annual plan and get 20% off the whole year. A full year of Means TV will run you just $88, which is like the cost of a single DoorDash meal these days. Every person who signs up using my link is directly contributing to the financial stability of my channel and the entire cooperative media project. None of this would be possible without the generosity of viewers like you. Both Second Thought and Means TV are entirely grassroots funded, and they always will be. So if you'd like to help support my work, consider signing up for Means TV using my link. It really does help me and dozens of principled socialist creators all across the platform. If you enjoyed this video, consider dropping a like. If you hated it, a thumbs down. You can check out my other content by following the links on your screen. Thanks for watching, and I'll see you next time.